4.
This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping the local area. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builder Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This week, we've been focusing on topics relating to the new year, and what better time to get a New Year's look at the economy from Dr. Elliot Eisenberg, noted national economist and longtime friend of the program, who joins us from South Florida, where it is much nicer than 40 degrees, Elliot, I presume.
Yeah, it's about 76, clear sky, sunny, beautiful.
All right, very. Yeah, no, once again, no, you're not. I'm sure that you.
Sorry for you.
Yeah, well, it's okay. We'll take that. So overall, let's keep our focus here. We could get into a whole weather discussion. That's another show. As 2024 begins, what's your overall assessment of the U.S. economy?
Right now, it's still hanging strong. It's, I would say, remarkably resilient. The labor market's been strong. As a result, consumer spending has been strong on both goods and both services. Inflation's coming down. I don't know how long it will last. That's another question. But right now, it's lovely. It really is. It's the economy was surprisingly strong in 23. Had you asked economists what would GDP growth, unemployment, and so on be, we would have all been wrong on the wrong way. We all would have thought it would have been worse. Maybe we would have had a recession, possibly.
Are
it was a great year.
Particular sectors that are doing especially well right now?
You know, it's remarkable. A lot of sectors are doing well, and partly it's because of COVID. So interest rates are high, and you'd think with high rates, interest-sensitive sectors would weaken. But auto sales turned out to be pretty good. 23 was the best year in several years since 19 before COVID started. Housing starts, existing sales are weak, but new home construction, single fam, very strong. And these sectors are doing well, and they're helping the economy. But services in general are strong because we have pent-up demand from COVID still. People want to still go out to rock concerts and, you know, see live music and travel and go to hotels and experience experiential things. So the economy's strong. The strongest sectors in terms of job growth are leisure, hospitality, healthcare, and government. That's a bit of a weak link because there aren't any other sectors that are still with good job growth. So those sectors are still catching up on the employment side. But on spending, people are spending across the board.
What about areas that are not doing as well, particular sectors?
You know, if you look at construction, multifamily construction, completions will be very strong in 24, starts will be very weak because interest rates are high, vacancy rates are up, cost of capital is high, rents are declining. And some other private sectors in construction aren't doing so well. That's one. And in general, manufacturing has been weak now in a contractionary mode for 14 or 15 months in a row. Hopefully the rate decline that we'll get sometime in the second half of 24 will hopefully ameliorate that and get manufacturing back on track. But manufacturing has performed very poorly.
Any particular reason you think that is?
On the construction side, the high rates are, that's the aim of the whole thing. Interest rates have gone up, labor costs are high, input costs are high, and so on. So firms say, oh, I'm not going to build a plant. I'm not going to build a warehouse. I'm not going to do something because that's the Fed wants. The Fed's saying, slow down, don't do it. So this is exactly what the Fed wants to happen. But if too many sectors like this go into the drink, then you can generate a recession. So, you know, if we have manufacturing and you get some construction activity and then you get something else, we got a problem on our hands. But so far, no problem.
As you look ahead, what is your forecast, recession or no?
So I think the answer is yes, but I there's a big caveat here. And the caveat is don't think of it like that. Think of it more like 24 likely to be a weaker year than 23. That's how to say. Look, if we don't have a recession, GDP growth will fall from, I don't know, we don't know what 23 was yet. Data's not out. But let's say it was 2.3%. So if we're lucky and we avoid a recession, GDP growth ends up at 1.25, 1.5. If we have a recession, we wind up with maybe 0.5% growth. So think of it that way. Don't say, oh, my God, the recession is coming. It's going to end the world. It's not. It won't be a terrible recession. It won't be a particularly long recession. But there may be a recession. I think the chances are pretty high we have one. I'm still in the camp of yes.
And how does that factor in with the inflation situation?
That's a great question. So the Fed would like to lower rates as soon as they can within limits, right? The problem is inflation right now is still well above trend. It's fallen from a peak of 9. It's now 3.5 or whatever it is. It's come down to 4. It's come down considerably. But there's still a way to go. If you want inflation at 2, you've still got work to do. So we're 2/3 or 3/4 of the way there, but we're not there yet. And they're not ready to lower rates. Now, if inflation happens to fall quickly just by good luck, the Fed will be more inclined to lower rates between now and, say, June. Otherwise, they'll wait till June or July to do it, I think. And, of course, if they see a recession on the horizon and labor numbers really starting to weaken profoundly, then they'll start cutting rates left, right, and center. And, you know, full speed ahead, damn the torpedoes, whatever. So we're in a wait-and-see mode right now. I think the Fed's objectively pretty happy with where they are with monetary policy. They're not going to cut prematurely. This notion of a 6 or 7 cuts this year, absent a recession, is not realistic. But 3 or 4 starting mid-year, that would be very nice. Unless we have a recession, then we get a lot more cuts.
Now, with the inflation picture, one thing I wonder about is, you know, you talk about it declining at 3% right now. But going forward, you've got these new numbers that are fixed in. You know, the cost of something went up. It may not be going up as much now, but it's not coming back down, which means that in a lot of areas, people's budgets and all of that are going to be strained for the long term.
Oh, there's no question. So there's a good news here and some bad news. The good news is inflation is now coming down. So wage growth is beginning to now exceed inflation. You get a 4% wage increase and inflation's 3. Oh, you're up 1. So this is good, no question. But, and you're 100% right, the cost of yogurt and fruit and an airplane ticket and a suit has gone way up. And people are angry, and I think this is one of the biggest problems that President Biden suffers from right now, is people are just going to the supermarket and they're perpetually irked that things are so expensive and as a result their cost of living has been reduced. Even though inflation right now is low, the cost of living has gone up considerably.
As we look at the housing market, of course, there's still the struggle with really a national housing shortage in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But also for people who were ready to upsize or downsize, a lot of them have put the brakes on that given the interest rates, especially if they've got a much lower interest rate loan currently.
You're absolutely right. And that's what's put the existing housing market really into the doldrums. There's very little activity. Activity is at decade lows or 20-year lows. When single family existing sales fall below 4 million, that's a remarkably rare event. And it's now happened for 3 or 4 months in a row because precisely the thing you said, people refinanced into a 3% mortgage and now rates are 6.5, down from 7.5. And they're saying, I don't care that we've had octuplets. We're still not moving. We'll buy bunk beds. So we need to see interest rates decline to get this pent-up demand to move from existing owners to put their homes on the market, and then they'll buy other homes, and the existing housing market will become fluid again. But we're not there yet, and rates at upper sixes are not enough to open up those floodgates.
And the people, the only ones really not impacted by that are folks who can work in the housing market and operate simply on a cash basis.
Right, and we see that. Cash purchases, NAR, National Association of Realtors, puts out data every month on this. And cash purchases are up a little bit, you know, from, I don't remember the numbers exactly, but they went up roughly 3 or 4 percentage points from 18 to 22 or whatever it was. It's up a little bit, not massively up, but it's certainly up, yes.
And here's a question that I'm not sure I've ever asked you before. What about the impact of AI, artificial intelligence, on jobs and industry and our economy?
You know, I'm a big fan of AI. So what I'm going to say next, don't think I'm not a fan. I am. I use it myself on a regular weekly basis. It saves me a couple hours a week. I'm very appreciative of AI. That said, if you look at the adoption of technology, whether it's a tractor or a train or a car in a farm or whatever it is, it takes a long time. And it takes a long time for, in this case, for firms to figure out how to collect data that they can in turn share with the computer to help train it and so on. So I think this is a much longer process than we think. There'll be early adopters, of course, but until this does its thing, this could take a decade or two. I'm much less concerned about job losses and all that kind of stuff. And there'll be some job losses, inevitably. But remember, 100 years ago, we were all farmers. So, you know, over 10 or 20 or 30 years, the economy adjusts pretty well. It has to all technological innovation in the past. And I'd be very surprised if we failed in that approach as this technology becomes increasingly widespread and ubiquitous.
You mentioned auto sales, and I'm curious, after a strong year, what is selling? What is not selling?
Oh, so sales are generally pretty good. What the biggest thing that we're seeing is a slowdown in electric vehicles. I think that's the most important thing. The automakers all spent a lot of money or were planning to spend a lot of money, say in 22, 21. And there's, oh, by 23, we're going to ramp up and build this and build factories and the battery plants and so on. And then suddenly demand has slowed. It's still growing, but it's not growing anything like they thought it was, because the early adopters bought into the cars. The people who wanted the discounts got them. And now you're stuck with people who are more resistant. They're resistant because they're more expensive. They're resistant because they have range anxiety. They're resistant because the filling stations, that's the wrong word, the electrical stations, don't work often. And people say, yeah, I can hold off. And we also know that the next year or the year after, there'll be 100 more varieties of car. There'll be tons more models out there from the manufacturers. So people are holding off. They're still buying more cars year over year, but the growth is slowing.
And what I'm seeing around here is an increased interest in hybrids. People like that idea and like some of the benefits there. But I heard about one person recently with an electric who had a college student return back to Eastern Washington from here, which is a very long day's drive if you want to do it. And they ended up, though, it ended up being a multi-day trip because they had to keep stopping to get the electric vehicle
charged.
And suddenly it went from a two-day trip to a 4 or 5-day trip.
Right. And that's the hybrid. Remember, Toyota was the one that got hybrids really going with the Prius. That was the first really successful vehicle. And they were poo-pooed a year or two ago when the head of Toyota said, well, we're going to stick with the hybrids, and we'll do some investment on the EV side too. And people said, oh, you're not moving, adopting fast enough. And now he's laughing the last and laughing the hardest. So, you know, it's hard to know what people want, but he was dead on. Toyota was absolutely right.
What about world concerns as we look beyond our U.S. borders at other nations? Which ones are having some big economic issues?
Oh, my, that's a bad question. So Canada's not looking particularly good up to our north. They're teetering on recession. If they're lucky, they avoid it barely, but there's no growth going on right now. And there hasn't been for 8 or 9 months. It's been barely any growth. Mexico, on the other hand, is doing pretty well. The friendshoring, reshoring thing, automobile sales being strong in the U.S. has certainly helped Mexico. Latin America, they're beginning to lower interest rates. And some commodity prices going up has certainly helped them. So they're a little better off, and they're further ahead of us in monetary policy. But England, so the UK in general, Europe, they're all weak. There's certainly really strong weakness there and some inflation. So the central banks there are struggling. But they may or may not go into recession, but there's nothing exciting going on there. And China, which is the big story, because their economy is two-thirds as big as ours, and they're having, for China, very weak growth. So they could be growing at 4.5, 5, and they'll probably end up growing at 4, and they'll be slowing as the decade goes on. And they're now making mistakes in fiscal policy. They're making some fundamental errors. Either no one knows quite why. Is it because the leadership there wants to slow the economy down, or because they want to have exert more party control, and they consider having a party control more important than economic growth? It's hard to tell exactly, but nonetheless, they're making errors, which is reducing their growth.
For the
it's a weak globe, I would say. India is doing well.
For the U.S.,
too, but that's it.
For the U.S. economy, what about the budget deficit situation? I heard some startling numbers this morning or next about where the already seemingly large budget deficit might morph to in the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, the deficit now is roughly 100% of GDP. The public debt is roughly 100% of GDP. And it's well on its way to, you know, 110, 120, 130. Last year, the deficit was 7% of GDP. That's partly why the economy was so strong last year. This year, the deficit won't be any bigger and maybe a little bit smaller. So fiscal policy is tight, monetary policy is tight. So 24, as I said, won't be a great year. But getting back to your question, yeah, we have to begin to get our deficit under control. And if we do that, the debt will get under control. But running these large deficits of 6-7% in peacetime without a non-pandemic era, this is really objectively a no-no. We could do it for COVID. Yeah, sure, it's a once-in-a-generation lifetime thing, but not on a sustained basis. It will slowly reduce economic growth as taxes have to go up and so on. This is very destructive in the long run. We should get our house in order.
Do you feel like Americans are faring better than they were 4 years ago?
That's a great question. I think, look, the labor market's strong. Job growth is good. Wage growth is now starting to pick up. So at many levels, yes. But the surveys all say absolutely not. Surveys of households, surveys of small businesses, you know, all those types of what do you think, what do you feel, are we on the right track or wrong track or so on, they're all objectively bad. And my suspicion, as I mentioned earlier, is I think it's really an inflation story. The rapid inflation that we experienced from mid-21 through end of 23, I guess, has really done a number on income. And people are unhappy and upset. And they think back to the Trump administration and say, huh, inflation wasn't a big concern then. So they look at that and they say, I'm worse off.
So how might this impact the presidential election that's kicking off really in just a few days?
Yes, right. So if we look right now at the prognosticators, I'm not an expert in there. The experts say if the election were held today, which is a big if, right, President Trump wins because he picks up 4 or 5 of the swing 6 states that are out there that really matter. Arizona, you know, there are half a dozen, Wisconsin and Michigan, whatever. So he picks it up. But the fly in the ointment is, first, there's 10 months to go before the election, or 11 months to go before the election. And the issue is for President Trump, the issue is, will he be convicted? And the surveys all show that if he is convicted, a small but sizable percentage of his support goes away. So his job is to delay all these trials against him until he becomes president and either can get rid of them or they go away, one or the other, or temporarily go away. That's his plan. And President Biden hopes inflation falls rapidly, the Fed lowers rates, and by summer, our economy's roaring. We'll see.
Now, some of the...
I don't think any other candidate realistically has a chance unless President Trump ends up being found guilty, right, and is convicted.
Well, I'm curious about that part because surveys show about 60-64%, depending on the survey, of Americans don't want a Trump-Biden rematch.
Oh, for sure. For sure not. I don't know anybody on either side of this debate, you know, Republican-Democrat, that's looking forward to voting for their candidate. I think everybody would like another candidate, be it Republican and or Democratic. Yeah, give us, you know, Nikki Haley or Christie on the Republican side, the Democratic side. There are no contenders, really. It's hard to say. But, yeah, I think everyone's desperate for a non-rematch. But, hey, that's not what that's not what we got, unfortunately.
Interesting. It'll be real curious to see how this goes. And one of the other things that
it's a sad thing because, you know, when elections come, you want to fall in love with a candidate. You want to love your candidate, at least at the beginning. And we're all being deprived of that chance. We're looking at two older guys, you know, who are just very unpopular for very different reasons, but both very unpopular.
And some people, regardless of whether they're to the right or to the left, point to the age factor and say, can we not find people under the age of 80 to run the country?
Absolutely. And that's a big issue. You like older politicians, for sure. They have experience and they're calm and cool and collected. But 80 years old seems a bit of a stretch. And when by the time they finish their term, they'll be 86 and 84, respectively. I think President Trump is 2 years younger than President Biden. There's not a big difference there. Yeah, you'd like presidents who are 20 years younger, you know. But unfortunately, this is what we got. Great country, not great politicians to choose from.
As we get close to wrapping up, let's switch gears. What about the top vacation destinations in 2024? What are you looking at?
Oh, my gosh. So I'm somewhat biased. I think of the places that I happen to like a lot. And there are ones that are pretty popular. But out east, you've got to look at places like Savannah and Charleston. They're absolutely beautiful. Airport service is pretty good. Prices are high. They're lovely. Aspen is beautiful in winter and summer. It's a great place to go. I mean, there aren't a lot of new places under the sun. In Oregon, Bend is always popular, and it's now super popular again. It's a key destination zone for people living there full time as well. So this is a laundry list of places that we all know and love from before, but there's strong demand for these places. Hotel prices. I mean, I'll tell you a funny story. I'm going to Aspen, and the hotel price there for one night midweek, $2,000.
Wow. That's amazing. Hey, if people want to get connected with you and your financial advice, talk about your daily email real quick.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I put out every day 70 words on economics, no graphs, no ads, no charts, no links, no photos. And the easiest way to sign up is take your phone and text the word bow tie, one word, no hyphen, no space, to the five-digit number 668-66-66 and the word bow tie, one word. You'll be prompted for an email address. You'll hear from me every day.
Dr. Elliot Eisenberg, thanks for joining us to begin the new year.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. I wish you and yours and all your listeners a great 2024.
All right, you as well. 1257 at News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.